Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Christopher Dewdney. He's an acclaimed poet and author of Last Flesh, Life in the Transhuman Era, which established him as one of Canada's leading futurists. Christopher Dewdney lives in Toronto, Canada, where he teaches creative writing at York University. Now, Christopher, you come to transhumanism from a slightly different route than most of the folks who generally end up here. You come from the arts and media and culture kind of perspective, and most of the folks who end up in this neck of the woods come out of the science, computer, technology kind of perspective. Do you think that is there any culture shock being a humanist in this very technophilic culture?
Well, sometimes there's a little bit of a turbulent interface, I might say, between myself and some of the more technologically oriented people who have been attracted to transhumanism. But generally speaking, I don't notice really a lot of two solitudes or a problem in communication. I'm kind of there with them on that one. I guess really I'm kind of uncharacteristic of coming from a literary background as well as a nonfiction background. I'm not really typical, I think, of my heritage.
Yeah. Do you find inspiration in historical resources like 19th century, 20th century speculations about the future that were reflected in literature and fiction? Have you tried your hand at science fiction, for instance?
Science fiction, of course, when I was younger, I read prodigiously. I used to clean out libraries. When I was 11, I can remember reading the last science fiction book, at least the last one I hadn't read at my local branch and having to go to the main branch. And so science fiction was seminal for me at the beginning. I have trouble reading science fiction now simply because I've become more literary since then, and science fiction is a bit of a genre. But what I read in place of science fiction are books like Eric Drexler's Engines of Creation or Hans Moravec's Robot. I find those to be exciting in a sense of science fiction in terms of speculating about possible future worlds, but also exciting because these are scientists and these ideas are actually plausible.
Now, you teach in a McLuhan-named program there. Have you written and thought a lot about, I presume you have, the way that technology is going to impact on the arts and culture? I mean, do you see that this is, do you think that there's going to be a qualitative change as the communication technologies advance?
Yes, I think that what I'm most looking forward to in terms of, well, let's just look at literature. There's already an effect on literature in terms of, although it's we're at the beginning of a very incremental process, but when you're doing, for instance, a grammar check, and I know that the grammar check isn't that that great or expert, but it does look for passive sentences, the Kincaid level of passive sentences. That is a kind of intervention, a kind of an apprentice, an assistant. That's the way I look at computers now, are sort of digital apprentices. They're learning what we do. They're learning how to do what we do, and they're still at a very primal or nascent stage. But eventually, they're going to pick up some tricks from us. And I sort of see it as an augmentation or an extension or a freeing up of artistic ability. And I think that the first kind of prediction that I'd like to make is that what we'll have in music, particularly because as music is being digitized very rapidly, almost more so than some of the other fields. We'll certainly have the ability shortly to be able to whistle a tune into a microphone, have that tune scored, and then be able to instruct the computer to the program to score it for violin, say, or for electronic organ, or for harmonica, and layer it. And at that stage, you'll have a device which will be able to be somebody who is not disciplined. You'll have the first non-disciplined geniuses, people who have compositional abilities, but who don't have disciplinary problems. I mean, disciplinary in the sense of not being able to apply themselves, or people who perhaps have some sort of inability or disability, will suddenly flower, and this will be an interesting period in art.
You're a Canadian, and this field of speculation about transhuman future tends to be very America-centric, or at least it's been American-led so far. And a lot of political assumptions, a lot of political world views have been encapsulated in the writings of people like Drexler. Do you find, perhaps you're comfortable with the technology, but do you find sometimes that as a Canadian, there are some alien America-centric political ideas coming along as baggage with these ideas?
That's an interesting idea. Of course, there was the whole hubris of the technocentric financial wired world bubble, which did burst, as they say, a few years ago. That's probably just a necessary correction. I mean, the fact that this technology is being originated in America does not change the effects of the technology. The technology will affect Americans as it affects all humans. There might be a slight characteristic stamp, perhaps. If, for instance, when we create an artificial intelligence, I don't think that the national identity of wherever it's originated will be primary in its circuits or in terms of its characteristic circuits. What will be most primary, I think, will be the values of the people who created it or the scientists created it. So I suspect that, if anything, we'll find, if there is a sort of a concocted artificial intelligence, that it will have more scientific values than perhaps artistic or emotional values at the beginning. So that certainly will be an imprint. But I don't really see, I'm happy that America is strong enough and diverse enough that some of these extraordinarily adventurous and avant-garde notions in science are able to be, it's a fertile ground for those ideas. And that's a very essential thing.
Well, one of the things that's concerned me about the America-centricness of the transhuman idea is that, for instance, the values of social solidarity that are expressed in the Canadian health insurance structure are missing in the United States. And I can imagine that in the future, as we have some of the technologies that you discuss in your book, The Last Flesh, Life in the Transhuman Era, some of those technologies which we transhumanists are concerned with will greatly exacerbate the differences between the wealthy and the poor. And those tensions might be ameliorated if we had a kind of Canadian sensibility and political structure.
That's a good point. The whole issue around, for instance, chronics or certain moral issues which arise out of biotechnology, it is interesting to see how they are dealt with by various types of societies. The English government, at least some people, some scientists who were at least allied with the English government early on in the chronics debate, I forget exactly the time or the issue, but there was a notion of there where there was something, a more of a socialist instrument in place, where the idea of individuals freezing themselves or becoming using money to suspend themselves was in some sense undemocratic, and that this person, his name I forget, who was a scientist, said that it was intrinsically undemocratic for some people to survive and other people's not. His view was that nobody should survive, which I found kind of frightening. So there is this notion, which is nice, a lovely American notion of non-interference by government in the destiny of the individual, sort of the individual uber alles. And that's not a bad thing. But on the other hand, it would be nice to be able to have a society that gave the benefits of science to everybody, as opposed to, but this is, of course, utopian. And I think that the birth of these technologies and the birth of new realities and of the new human, incrementally, of course, species will be perhaps messy.
Are you optimistic about the rapidity of change, or are you more of a pessimist on the singularity meter?
Everything, take the most cool, level-headed predictions by the proponents of a new technology and multiply that by five, a factor of five, and I think you get the actual timeline for events. I mean, I can remember it in 1969, I guess it was, when 2001 came out, seeing that film, or 68, which was, the Stanley Kubrick film. it seemed I thought he was being very conservative in terms of they're only having a one moon colony established, and that the moon travel, inter-Earth moon travel, seemed to be somewhat at a nascent stage. It wasn't like at a busy airport. And I think everybody felt that. It was like, you know, of course, this is probably the way things will be. But we didn't get anywhere near that kind of a level of a technological achievement by 2001. That was a 30-year scan of the future that completely failed that vision. And so things will always happen slower than you think.
I'm Dr. J. You're listening to Change Surfer Radio, and we're talking today with Christopher Dewdney. Christopher Dewdney is an acclaimed poet, author of Last Flesh, Life in the Transhuman Era, and he teaches creative writing at York University. One of the dialogues that I'm hoping will develop in the near future is between the folks in the critical social studies of science and technology crowd and the culture studies crowd, who have been influenced by Donna Haraway's Cyborg Manifesto and that whole field of cyborgology, as it's sometimes called, and the transhumanists. We have very rarely seen any kind of dialogue between those two schools, and they have a lot in common, since Haraway and the cyborgologists are very interested in the ways that technology is transgressive. You're someone who's probably better positioned to see those intersections. Have you had much to do with the Haraweans? And there's some actual cyborgs up there also. Steve Mann, the cyborg professor, is up there someplace, isn't he?
Steve Mann is at the University of Toronto here.
Right, that's right.
And he has a small group of, I think, 14 postgraduate students who are also wearing headsets continuously 24 hours a day, some of them sometimes 18 hours a day. He's really at the forefront of research of interfaces between human perceptual systems and machine augmented systems.
The cyborgologist critique of technology and society goes past the people who are actually implementing cyborgology.
Well, they're interested. Really, in a certain sense, they're empiricists, and the kinds of effects and data that they are recording, and the kind of psychological ramifications they have are all raw data. It's quite new. It's not being critiqued in a sociological sense or a cultural sense the way that Haraweans are critiquing that whole issue. And I think that some of the people on the cyborg side would be a little aghast at the kind of assumptions that a social critique of their motivations and some of the impulses behind what they do would make them feel perhaps a little overly analyzed or perhaps just the way somebody who's being psychologically analyzed often feels a little vulnerable.
Although Steve Mann, recently he had a run-in with the U.S. Customs post 9/11 U.S. Border Patrol, and they made him take off all of his cyborg equipment, and he wrote quite movingly about his sense of disorientation, and unfortunately they destroyed some of it in the process, but he wrote quite movingly about his disorientation in a way that made, I'm sure, people who weren't sympathetic with the cybernetic future say, you know, look, here's an example, someone who wears this stuff all the time, and when you take it away from him, he's helpless as a baby. So, you know, it seems like he himself supports with his empirical data some of the
exactly,
critique.
In a sense, what I was saying was that he, you know, I mean, where he has gone is places where humans have never been. And he has developed an exoskeleton, a pan-communicative web exoskeleton that is connected to his own consciousness that he's kind of fused with. It's like a hermit crab, in a sense. I don't know, you know those crabs that have the shells that they have to keep. When they get larger, they have to find a new shell to put their abdomen into. It's a little bit prosthetic in that sense, and that's kind of what he's into.
How about yourself? Is technology your muse, or are you also an avid practitioner?
I've been sort of going through a slight disengagement with technology lately, simply because I'm working on a book of a very unrelated to technology for HarperCollins, and so I'm not thinking about it as much, although I'm using my wonderful computer, which I sort of see now as an auxiliary brain, and to a certain extent interfaces with these devices or with augmented intelligence don't have to wire them to our brain. We're already using them in a certain sense. I kind of, that whole idea of implants, I wonder how necessary that will be in the end. But yeah, I'm very much very, very pro new technology and keeping up with everything that's going on, and I'm very interested in biotechnology and bioengineering particularly.
Have you signed up to be frozen?
I still haven't signed up yet, but I have the folders here, and I keep in touch with an Alcor representative. But what I'd like to do is actually have the money up front as opposed to doing it on, you know, I'd like to be, well, I guess, wealthy enough to afford it in cash as opposed to doing it through the through life insurance, that kind of thing.
Are you familiar with Bruce Sterling's Viridian movement? He's made the argument that one of the ways for us to change the addiction to energy-intensive and wasteful production in Western society is to have artists engage with the task of design, and that there should be more ecological or green design going on. It seems like this is a similar situation with the transhumanist movement, that for those of us who see this as an ideological movement where we want to establish the right and desirability of people to transcend human limits, not very many of us have been very skilled at articulating an attractive, a sexy vision of this. All of the visions that seem to come from mass culture are about how terrible it would be if people lived a long time, and how terrible it would be if people transcended human limits. Do you think we need to have a kind of a conscious cultural strategy for the transhumanist movement?
Well, there's a number of things that are predicated on that idea. One is the notion that transhumanism is something that needs to be sold to a wider public, and if so, why? What would be the benefits of having more people aware of the transhumanist values and goals? Is that a good thing, or would it be better for transhumanists to simply labor quietly building the new world on their own without much attention from the media? As God only knows, it could be turned into a bad thing, or it could turn into a very good thing. But if I was going to try and, I guess what you call, sell the idea of transhumanism, it seems to me it's tacitly obvious that it is, and I suppose this is my own inability to sort of frame the issue in broader societal modes, but it seems to me who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want to be enhanced, to live longer, to be younger? To be vital, to think better, to be smarter, to think faster. All these things are things that we've always wanted. And in fact, they're intrinsic. They're built into. And this is what I argue in my book, The Last Flesh, is that these are all impulses that are built into us, have been built into us for thousands of years. These are aspirations that are deeply inside of us. We've used metaphors of various types of religions and things to convey them into mythology. But in a sense, what we have now with technology is the beginning of actually being able to realize all these timeless, immemorial dreams of ours that have languished in our souls for thousands of years. Immortality, godlike powers, youth, beauty, truth, happiness, all these things that are really what drive us in terms of racially as a people, as human beings, are maybe obtainable individually. That's the first point. The second point is that transhuman movement has to make a kind of a declaration of independence or something, a document along those lines, which really spells out things fairly carefully, because the movement is starting to grow now, and in leaps and bounds, it seems to me. I can tell from activity on the web. And there's a number of marginal, as always, people who are drawn into the movement that need perhaps a bit more of a guideline as to what the principles and aspirations of transhumanism actually are. So that really needs to be defined clearly and eloquently.
I definitely agree with that. There has been this problem of people who think that the idea, that think that we're pursuing an old 1930s vision of eugenics, for instance, and are attracted for some very unfortunate reasons because of that. Whereas our vision, it tends to be, you know, entirely the opposite, a libertarian notion, at least in terms of people's control of their own genetic destiny. Mm-hmm. And the complete irrelevance of race and gender and all those other categories, mm-hmm. if, once people are able to transcend them.
Yeah, the interesting thing, of course, is how what does society is the relationship between transhumanity and society and transhumanists who are transhumanists, it seems, are usually educated, very liberal individuals who are probably fairly intelligent as well, don't really represent the broad normal range of society, so that there's a bit of a discrepancy already in the ideals that such a group would have. For instance, let's I remember talking at a party to somebody, I think it was a brother-in-law, and I was telling them about the kinds of things that might be possible in the future. One of them was being, I said that we might be able to select through, genetic alteration. We could actually alter the genetic structure of individuals, and we could say program eyes, you know, let's say your eye color, for instance, it could be violet, or you could have longer fingers, or those kinds of I was saying things that were a little perhaps alien sounding. He said, "Well, I just want to be 7'4" and beat the hell out of everybody else. That's all I want. I want to be really good at sports. I want to be the best damn I guess it was football player the world's ever seen. Or I want to slam dunk baskets." And I thought, "Oh my God, of course that's." I'd never thought of it, because I'm not, in a sense, part of that broader spectrum of normal society, I guess, in a sense, although I enjoy it. But here you have, his ideals were just to be bigger and stronger and meaner than everybody else, to turn into kind of a super athlete, which I'd never even thought of before. And then I thought of, what will people do out there if they could change their looks? I mean, they'll all look like Gwyneth Paltrow and Brad Pitt. There'll be this incredible, horrible monotony. So there are ways it could turn, it could turn badly if we have control over our own destiny, given the proclivities of today's society. Anyway.
I think that that's a it's a very interesting concern, because we do see this cult of the body among young men, and the lengths that young men are willing to go, taking steroids, et cetera. And in the future, when they have more control over their body, we can imagine even more extreme excesses. Hopefully, the safer alternatives, but more extreme opportunities as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really want to thank you for joining us. Tell us a little bit, before I let you go, about what your next book's going to be about.
Well, right now I'm working on a book, which I guess will probably just be called Transhuman, and... to be blunt about it, I will see if that works with in terms of the publishers. But what I'm really looking at, I wanted to get back to explain this transhumanity in a really down to earth in a public sense, in a very broad band way that would normal readers could relate to. And so I'm starting off starting off with language as being really the first. I suppose you might call it exogenous or slightly the first technological artifact that began to mutate us through its development. That language, in a certain sense, was the beginning of that prosthetic technology. I'm saying that all language, that all technologies kind of arose out of the way language allowed us to manipulate the world. So in a sense, it was like first came the software and then comes the hardware. So I'm starting off with that, that evolution, and trying to take that whole idea and trying to trace back transhumanism back to, like, the term itself, for instance, goes back to Dante, who made the term translunar to describe the spiritual state of people who had seen angels and who had been in such celestial bliss that they had become more than human. So that's what, kind of the origin of that, of the term. And so looking at a lot of these kind of very pragmatic issues and really trying to tie it all in a kind of a practical way for a broader mass appeal type book.
That sounds great. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, it's going to take a little while, but that's one project I'm on right now.
We've been speaking today with Christopher Dewdney. Christopher Dewdney is an acclaimed poet and author of Last Flesh, Life in the Transhuman Era, which established him as one of Canada's leading futurists. He lives in Toronto, Canada, teaches creative writing at York University. Thanks so much for joining us today, Christopher.
Thank you very much.
When my kids asked, "Are there really unicorns?" I answered, not yet. That's when I realized there were challenges to being a futurist and a parent. When my daughter and her best friend were both interested in the same boy, they were delighted to learn that by the time they were of childbearing age, say 50 or so, group marriage would be legalized and accepted. After a simple question about the risks of natural disasters in our area prompted a lengthy explanation of global warming, rising ocean levels, and climatic change over the next 100 years, my son spent weeks worrying about our inadequate preparation for the imminent flood. Chats about what kids will do when they grow up get tricky when you're sure that most work will be automated, and any jobs they may be lucky enough to hold probably haven't even been imagined yet. Yes, there will be veterinarians, but they will probably tend industrial meat vats or service lines of cloned designer pets. One of the conversations that stands out for me was the classic, "Daddy, will I die?" followed by, "Daddy, will you die?" For years, I've grown increasingly enthusiastic about life extension medicine and the prospect of genetic therapies and nanorobotic immune systems for dramatically extending life expectancy. Since my kids are 7 and 9, they stand a very good chance of living to benefit from the exponential acceleration of biotechnology and our control of aging. But can I really tell a child, "Well, I'm probably going to die, but you have a shot at meditating on the heat death of the universe"? I didn't say that. I was worried first that teachers and other responsible adults would hear I was offering immortality to the kids and accuse me of setting them up for cruel disillusionment. Then I worried that I might in fact be disserving them by not acclimating them to the inevitability of death. If they get to live 1,000 years, perhaps it should just be a surprise. More painfully, I find I can't really be honest with them, that I feel